Welcome and thank you all for standing by. At this time, I would like to remind parties that your lines are on a listen-only mode until the question and answer session, at which time you may press star one to ask a question. Today's call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I will now turn the meeting over to Glenn Nowoff. Thank you, sir. You may begin.
Thank you, and thank you all for your interest and attendance today, both on the phone and in the room. Today's media briefing on our update on this novel H1N1 virus will be conducted by Dr. Richard Besser. And I'll turn the podium over to Dr. Besser.
Thanks very much, Glenn. I want to thank you all for being here for today's briefing. This remains a dynamic situation. Each day, we learn a lot more about transmission here and around the world. And I want to say that we remain concerned. I'll be giving the numbers shortly, but we are seeing continued spread around the country. We are seeing an increase in numbers of cases. And I want to make sure that people understand that changes in guidance that take place are based on science, based on what we think are the appropriate measures to minimize impact on people's health. And we're going to remain appropriately aggressive in terms of those measures. As we learn more, as the science develops and is refined, we're able to tailor those measures more appropriately. Yesterday, we heard in the news, and we heard here at CDC, about the death of a woman in Texas, and I want to send my sympathies to her family. Any death is sad. This really, I think, reminds us that influenza can be a very serious infection, and it's one that we need to continue to take very seriously. Yesterday, we refined our guidance. We issued new guidance on school closure and daycare closure, and I want to make sure people know that those guidances are up on the web. This is a good example of how we use science to inform policy. And so as we've learned more about the severity of the virus, as we've learned more about the severity of infection, as we've learned more about transmission, we're going to continue to refine our guidance. And that's something that people should expect. We've had some questions from the media about the length of time for school closure and why we had 14 days before and why we're talking now about 7 for children. This plays in again to the issue of uncertainty and severity. At a time when we still knew very little about severity, when the reports out of Mexico were of a much higher severity disease than we are currently recognizing, the guidance was saying up to 14 days. And the reason for that is one incubation period is about 7 days. And so if you're dealing with something that's quite severe, and you may see some variability on shedding, you go for safety zone, and there we recommended 2 incubation periods. As we now see that this infection is not as severe as we had initially feared, we can cut back on that and realize that, yes, after 7 days, there may be some children who are still shedding, but they'll be shedding less virus, and it's an appropriate action that after 7 days, they may return to school. Let me give the case number updates. As of 11 a.m. today, we're reporting 1,487 probable and confirmed cases in 44 states. That's an increase of around 400 from yesterday. There are around 850 probable cases and 642 confirmed cases. The confirmed cases are in 41 states, so that's an increase of 3 states with confirmed cases from yesterday. In terms of the age range, the median age for cases is 16 years, with a range of 3 months to 81 years. 58% of the cases in the U.S. are under 18 years of age. We have reported a total of 2 deaths, and we have 35 hospitalizations, which are confirmed, plus 17 hospitalizations that are probable. The median age for hospitalized patients is 15 years. That's for confirmed hospital cases. And that's about the same as for cases in general. The age range for hospitalization is 8 months to 53 years. We have reported hospitalizations of confirmed cases from 14 states. Looking at underlying disease, for the 13 individuals for whom we have that detailed information, seven of them had known conditions that would put them at risk for more severe infection. The World Health Organization is reporting 1,500 cases, roughly 1,500 cases in 22 countries, with Canada, Spain, and the United Kingdom having the highest case counts outside of the U.S. And Mexico. Mexico has been reporting 822 confirmed cases and 29 deaths. We've been talking about what does the epidemic look like in Mexico, and we have quite a number of people in Mexico. I'll talk about that in a moment. But I think that we need to put in context the idea of, is it going away in Mexico? What we hear about in Mexico is what we are seeing and will continue to see here, is when you see a large outbreak or an epidemic, it's frequently made up of a series of smaller outbreaks and epidemics. So what they're seeing in Mexico is parts of the country where they're seeing increases in disease and parts of the country where they're seeing decreases. And when you add that all up together, it may show some leveling off, but it doesn't really give a sense of how dynamic the situation is. Here in the United States, each day we're reporting new states that are seeing disease. And so we will start to see in those states increases, and at some point we'll be starting to see in states decreases. The rapid increases in confirmed cases that I had predicted for today that we're reporting is largely due to the ability of more and more states to do testing. And so some of the backlog on testing is going to lead to catch up, and we're going to continue to see those numbers increase. In addition, we're going to continue to see additional people get sick. So I don't want to attribute it all to testing, but in terms of our ability to confirm cases, we're seeing more of that around the country. We're continuing to see virus spread in the United States and around the globe. The majority of the confirmed cases in this country are in younger people, and it's important that people have respect for this virus, because it does each year cause severe disease, hospitalization, and death. We don't know yet about issues of population immunity. What we're seeing, and as we've talked about in previous days, we're not seeing as much disease in the elderly. This could be due to some underlying protection, or could be due to just the dynamic of it starting with the younger population before it travels to the elderly. Everything we see to date leaves us with the understanding that we need to remain vigilant. We cannot let up on this. It's important that people understand that there's shared responsibility, that people need to continue to wash their hands, cover their cough, and most importantly, when they're sick, not send their children to school, not go to work when they're sick. Those measures can help reduce the spread in communities and keep people protected. An update on some of the public health actions. The stockpile of all states have received their 25% allotment. We're in the process of replenishing some of our stockpiles through purchases. CDC has been actively engaged. Over 900 CDC employees are responding to this outbreak. That does not include our individuals around the globe who work in laboratories, who are working with other countries on their surveillance. We have 93 people in the field, including 16 in Mexico, and we have 33 more who are pending deployment. The PCR test kit has been deployed around the country to all states and Puerto Rico. We've shipped it as well to 16 countries. And so this will help with the diagnostic capabilities around the world. And as I said, this will also increase the number of cases through testing alone. We continue to work to understand the virus and the illness that it's causing. It's very important that we understand transmission in various populations. We're working with Texas and California, and we'll be sending two EPI investigation teams there to look in particular at the issue of healthcare worker transmission. We want to see what are the dynamics of transmission, are there certain practices that are putting people at risk, and then if so, what can be done to tailor the guidance that we currently are providing in that area. I want to put a little focus today on the issue of pregnancy and disease risk. So far, we are aware of 6 confirmed and 5 probable cases of H1N1 infection involving pregnant women. This is not a higher rate than would be expected in the general population. However, pregnancy is a risk factor, a known risk factor for more severe disease. We want to make sure that clinicians have information on how they should approach the issue of infection in pregnancy, and that women who are pregnant have this information as well. So on our website, we have for pregnant women fact sheets on what pregnant women should know, and we have guidance that's up there for clinicians so that if they have a patient who's pregnant, they'll understand how antivirals should be used, what the treatment strategy should be in that circumstance. So in closing, I want to remind you, we do expect to see more school outbreaks. We do expect to see more clusters around the country. We do expect to see more transmission. We do expect to see disease in all states. We continue to be working actively in the area of vaccine development, that's a critical part of strategies moving forward. Seasonal vaccine is in production. We are moving forward on the development process for a novel H1N1 vaccine. We're taking those initial steps that are very important and necessary should a vaccine need to be made. There are a lot of decisions that would need to be made between now and people receiving a vaccination, and the decisions will be based on the best available science. Lastly, I want to just address the issue of WHO and levels. And as we've discussed before, WHO levels have to do with a number of factors. One is there sustained transmission of a novel virus? We've met that. For us to move, or for WHO to move from a level 5 to a level 6, they would look to see, is there sustained transmission of this virus in more than one WHO region? And right now, they've not confirmed that yet. They just have sustained transmission in this World Health Organization region. With the number of cases in other countries, I would be surprised if we don't get to a level 6. We are not there yet, and WHO has not made that move. One of the hallmarks of flu viruses is that they undergo constant and dramatic change. And so we are continuing to actively look at the virus in the laboratory. As the flu season starts in the southern hemisphere, what takes place there is going to be incredibly important. How does the virus compete with other viruses that are circulating in the community? Does it change? Does it mutate? If so, in what way? Does it develop resistance? Those are factors, those are studies that will be ongoing as we move through that period. We will continue here at CDC to give you the information we know when we know it. We're going to continue to let you know what we don't know, and we're going to provide these updates on a daily basis for as long as necessary. So with that, let me turn to your questions, starting here in the room.
Thanks, Dr. Besser. Betsy McKay from the Wall Street Journal. I have two questions, one about vaccine and one about hospitalization. On the vaccine question is, would, if this virus changes, mutates and becomes more virulent, sort of the 1918 pattern, are we able to know right now that a vaccine that you're developing would be protective against more virulent forms? The second, about hospitalization, I'm wondering how normal a pattern that the age group that is hospitalized, how normal that really is for, compared with seasonal flu vaccine, because the median age of 15 seems really young.
Right. So the first question in terms of should they, if the virus changes over this period of time, will a vaccine work? That's a great question. Each year with seasonal flu, the virus changes. And at the time decisions are made as to what strain goes in the vaccine, you don't know what will be here the following season. And so there's a process to pick that each year for seasonal flu, and it involves experts from around the world making their best science-informed decisions. But at some point, there will need to be a decision, if you're going to go forward, which strain you use. And you won't know for sure until you know what's circulating in the following season. What we're seeing so far during the short period of time is a fair amount of stability in the virus. What happens in the fall is not is not known. In terms of the age distribution, you're right. We're seeing the same distribution in hospitalized patients as we are in milder cases in the community. And that's younger than what you would see in seasonal flu. In seasonal flu, you tend to see a predominance of burden of disease in the elderly and in the very young. And here we're seeing it more in the younger population. And so that is something we're keeping our eye on. That is something that raises concerns. And it plays into the question of why is that happening? Is it because that's the population that got sick first, population that may have traveled to Mexico on spring break, or is it something else regarding protection? Are the elderly potentially protected for some reason? Those are things that we're continuing to look at, but that is a great question. Another question here in the room.
Dr. Cece Connolly from the Washington Post. You mentioned Mexico. I'm wondering if you can elaborate a little bit more in terms of what exactly your teams are doing there. Now that we're 2 weeks or so into this, are you starting to gather some more useful information? And you also mentioned epi teams going to California and Texas to look at the question on healthcare workers. Can you also elaborate on that? Do you have a particular concern at this point?
Well, let me start with Mexico. And we have... I'm looking for the numbers, how many people we have down in Mexico. Thank you. Yeah, and 16 from Mexico, and we're going to be sending additional people there. There are a number of things we're doing. One is just working on trying to describe the basic epidemiology, and that's been so incredibly useful over the past 5 days in helping us understand the issue of severity. When initial reports out of Mexico were of very high rates of hospitalization and death, that was suggesting a very severe virus, and a virus that could have devastating consequences. As we've learned more, we've seen that this is a virus that appears to be widespread in the community, and that the issue of hospitalization and death was the tip of the iceberg phenomenon. So that has been very useful. Getting laboratories set up is something that Canada, the U.S., and Mexico worked on together, and that's been very helpful in sorting that out. Looking at spread around the country, the Mexican government is putting teams in various states to be able to describe in more detail the epidemiology on a state basis. That's something that we do here, and it's very useful because your decisions on what you're going to implement are most appropriately taken at that state and local level because different areas will be seeing different things and experiencing the outbreak in a different way. And so that's part of the assistance. But some of the new work that's going to be going on there is in the area of healthcare worker transmission and transmission to contacts of cases. This will be very useful in understanding prevention strategies. You know, when you're thinking about risk, who comes in contact with the most individuals who are sick and have flu? Healthcare workers. The people come in when they're sick. And we want to make sure that our guidance is as evidence-based as possible. And if there are opportunities to prevent infections in that setting, we want to know what those are and what works. We have guidance up on the web now, but as I said, as we gain information, we'll be able to tailor those interim guidances so that they're most effective. So that's the kind of work that's going to go on in Texas and California, and that's what the teams are assisting the Mexican government with as well. Let me take a question from the phone, please.
The first is from Ann Pasone, ABC. Your line is open.
Oh, thank you very much. Doctor, from the experience the CDC and the public health community has garnered these last few weeks dealing with H1N1, what is the most important changes or enhancements that need to be made to BioSense to better prepare for a more severe or intentional outbreak?
Thanks. BioSense is an electronic surveillance system that's in place in many places to look at various syndromes. So it can look and see how many people are coming in with flu-like symptoms. You can look to see how many people are coming in with a number of different conditions. And it's one of the systems that we are currently using to look at visits to hospitals. It's a useful piece of surveillance information. And so, you know, we will, as we go forward, look to see what pieces of surveillance information were most useful and provided good insight in terms of of what was taking place on the ground and what wasn't. I think it's premature for me to comment on any of the particulars because we haven't done the look back to say, okay, which pieces of information were critical or critically important to decision making at what point. I mean, how can we make sure that we've got a detailed understanding of what's going on in various places. Next question from the phone.
The next is from Robert Lowe's Medscape Medical News. Your line is open.
Dr. Besser, the people at WHO have announced that they will be looking at the possibility of, one, starting wholesale or mass production of the H1N1 vaccine, as well as possibly halting a production of seasonal flu vaccine. And part of that decision is predicated on, you know, how much has been produced so far of the seasonal flu vaccine. What's your reaction to that? Is that a prudent step?
I missed the first part of the
question. To consider halting seasonal flu vaccine production?
I missed the first part. Where did you say that was taking place?
The officials at WHO announced today that they would be convening experts to consider wholesale production of a new influenza virus, as well as halting production of seasonal flu vaccine.
Thanks. The World Health Organization has an expert committee that they convened to address global issues around pandemic flu. That's the body that helps inform them whether it's time to move phases of a pandemic. And that's a body that will help inform them as well in terms of the global position on vaccination. And the U.S. government has participation on that committee. I think we have three members on that committee. And so I'll be very interested to see what their discussions say and where they come down on the issue of vaccine production. Here in the United States, we're pushing forward with production of seasonal flu vaccine, and that's moving forward very aggressively. We're also undertaking those steps in the development of an H1N1 vaccine that are necessary to do now. So that's providing the virus strain, growing that up as a seed stock. And once that's grown up, providing that to manufacturers so that they could do initial studies if they were to move forward with a vaccine. And so World Health Organization has the responsibility for developing recommendations for the world, and we would definitely welcome, and we will be participating in those discussions. Let me take the next question here in the room.
Thanks, Mike Sobey from the AP. Doctor, two questions. First, following Betsy's about hospitalizations and the age, is age appearing to be as great or greater a risk for hospitalization than underlying condition? And then second, on underlying... Okay.
Yeah, I wouldn't put too much on the data that I gave you on hospitalization. In terms of the chronic condition, that was based on 13 people. And so it's that kind of information, when you're dealing with very small numbers, is subject to great change. And given that the number of people who are hospitalized is very small, you really run the risk of overinterpretation, because the range there was, I think, from 3 months to 81, no, from 8 months to 53 years. So it's a very wide range. When you talk about it as a median, the middle number of 15, it may signal a little more than you want to interpret there. But looking at hospitalizations and looking at risk by age is really, really important. And as this progresses, I fully expect we're going to see more hospitalized individuals, and we're going to continue to look at that factor.
Second question, on underlying conditions, understanding the point you just made about the small number of cases, can you tell us what underlying conditions are recurring in those, I guess, 13? And there's a lot of attention on the death yesterday. Was pregnancy in that case the underlying condition, or did she have something else that you believe exacerbated the death?
I don't have any additional information on the woman from Texas. The other patients, it was a wide range. There wasn't something that was popping up as a predominant. But again, there were only 7 people with a chronic condition. As we gather more information on that, what we'll be looking to see is is there a risk factor that is putting people at greater risk? Is it something that we can alert people to that would have protective value? But right now, we don't have that information. Thankfully, the number of hospitalized individuals is small. In the room? Yes.
Professor Michelle Marsh from CBS Atlanta News. I have two questions. One is, how soon do you project a vaccine will be available? And then the second is, various health officials are discussing the possibility of asking people to get 3 vaccinations by this fall, 1 for the regular flu and 2 installments for the H1N1 virus. Just want to get your response to that and
right.
whether that's a possibility.
Well, when vaccine would be available, it's really early to say because of all the steps that need to take place. What I can say is that we're doing all the steps necessary now should a decision be made to ramp up for vaccine production, and that is growing up the seed stock, making sure that that's going to be available to manufacturers, engaging in the discussions with industry so that they understand the virus and understand what studies they're going to need to be undertaking. In terms of the number of doses, just to put it in perspective, before a vaccine is administered to anybody, there's a series of studies that need to be taken. These are under the direction of NIH, and they're approved by the Food and Drug Administration. And what they'll look at is they need to do studies to determine how much stuff needs to be in the vaccine, how much of the what's called an antigen needs to be in the vaccine to stimulate protection, immunity. And then they'll also need to see, do you get sufficient immunity from one dose? Do you need more than one dose? And with each vaccine, it's different. With different age groups, it's different. And so it's really early to say how many vaccines someone's going to need until those studies are done. But that's going to be very important information because the number of doses you need will impact on how many people you'll be able to vaccinate. And you know, hopefully we'd be able to find a vaccine that works very readily with one dose. Back to the phone.
Elizabeth Weiss, USA Today, your line is open.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I had actually a question about the number of cases in Illinois, which has jumped and is now the highest in the nation. I know part of that's a testing artifact because they just got their kits over the weekend, but do your folks there have any sense of why Illinois has even more cases than New York at this point?
No, I would have to refer you to the folks in Illinois. To understand the testing dynamics. Mayor Bloomberg was here visiting CDC a little while ago, and his comment when he was meeting with the media was, you want 200 more cases? We'll test 200 more people. And so you may see in different places different approaches and strategies to testing. And so I don't know the specifics on Illinois, but I'd refer you to them on that. But some of the differences you're going to see by state have to do with where the virus is in transmission. Some of them are going to do have to do much more with where they are in ramping up their laboratory testing capability and what they report out. Another question from the phone?
The next is from Suzanne Hoholik, the Columbus Dispatch. Your line is open.
Hi. Thanks, Dr. Besser. I know you keep talking about these test kits, and Ohio authorities said they've not received theirs, and even though a couple of days ago it was supposed to be on their way. How many are coming, and when will they be here?
Well, I'll follow up after this press conference and see what the situation is there. The test kits have come out. Some of the states have not been able to fully use them yet because the first 5 runs need to be validated with our laboratory. And so we'll follow up and see what's going on with Ohio, but I appreciate that information. Next question from the phone.
The next is from Delphia Ricks, Newsday. Your line is open.
Thank you, Dr. Besser. I'd like to know, rather than a potential pandemic strain, could this possibly be a newly emergent H1N1 that may compete with or replace the current H1N1 in circulation?
I think I missed the beginning. You were asking whether the strain we're seeing here could replace the other H1N1 that's in circulation. Is that right?
No, not a potential pandemic strain. Could this be one that is newly emergent, but will ultimately replace the H1N1 in circulation? In other words, we may not really be looking at a pandemic strain.
Well, what we need to look at is what happens in the southern hemisphere, and that's going to be very important. How does this H1N1 compete with other H1N1s and other strains that are in circulation? The difference between this strain and other H1N1 is that this is a novel strain that has many components. It has a swine component, it has an avian component, it has human components. And it's a strain to which we feel the population does not have immunity. The other H1N1 that's been circulating is one to which many people probably have some baseline immunity, given that if they were vaccinated last year or they've been exposed to this before. So it's kind of a confusing point. There are different H1N1s. This one here, this novel strain, is one that we feel more people would be at risk for, and that's why it's different from the one in circulation. Whether it replaces it or not, it will be hard to say, but that's what we want to look at in coming up. Back to the room.
Just a follow-up with the question that I had before. There's been a lot of concern that by the fall season, this may look like the calm before the storm. Can you speak to that as to what is being done to make sure that when the fall season comes around, things are not, we're not overwhelmed with even more cases than what we're seeing now?
Thanks. You know, I wish I could predict what we're going to see in the fall, because that would make it very easy to make the kinds of decisions we're going to need to make as a nation over the next few months. We could see a number of things happen. We could see the current strain fizzle out and never come back again. We could see the current strain come back as it currently is, or we could see it mutate and change and come back in a more severe form. What we need to do during this period is really a shared responsibility, and that's make sure that we're prepared. And that's making sure that we're prepared as a government and as a public health agency, and that our laboratories are ready and our epidemiologists are ready, and we're ready should this come back as a much more severe infection. We need our communities to be ready so that they would know what would they do if this came back and was really severe and we needed to take measures like closing schools. How would they ensure that children who got school lunch got that at home and we're not going to see problems in terms of nutrition? How do we ensure that parents who want to do the right thing and stay home with their child when they're sick can do that and not lose their job? Those kind of preparedness efforts over this period of time will really help minimize or reduce the impact should this come back more severe. It will also leave us prepared for any other type of emergency that could come to our community. Okay, last question from the phone, and then we'll take the last one in the room.
The next is from David Brown, Washington Post. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you. Dr. Besser, does CDC or HHS have any pre-production contracts, standing orders, so to speak, with vaccine manufacturers to buy a pandemic strain vaccine? And I'm not talking about H5N1, which is already bought, but standing orders now. And if it does, what? How many doses do you have on a standing order, and with what company?
David, I'm going to have to refer you on that question. Bruce Gellin in the department is the head of the National Vaccine Program Office, and that's the office that really is coordinating a lot of these efforts. And I don't know the answer to that question, but he would be able to address that. Last question in the room.
Thanks. Doctor, just following up your comment about preparation for the fall, when Mayor Bloomberg was here this morning, we asked if he was had any special preparations underway for the fall, and he said no. What should local communities be doing? Should the health departments be hiring, or certain staff should be trained in giving vaccinations? What do you think communities should be doing specifically?
Well, I think, just to clarify the mayor's comment, New York has done intensive pandemic planning. And so in terms of doing something special based on this, I think they're doing what everyone's doing, and that's looking at their plans, making sure that they're making the changes to those plans based on this strain and what's circulating and what needs to take place. As a federal government, we're doing that. We're constantly looking to see what have we learned so far, what changes do we need to make, and as we go forward to the fall, what pieces of information are going to be critical to some of the decisions that need to be made, what do we need to be sure that we're ready. I mean, one of the things that we've done that I already mentioned is already work to replace some of the stocks of antivirals, of Tamiflu, that have been distributed. So we're going to be building those stockpiles back up, so should they be needed, we have them ready. Thank you all very much. Appreciate it.